this hour's top stories. Iran's top negotiator Abbas Araghchi says the U.S. must ensure Tehran that its unilateral withdrawal from the 2015 nuclear deal will not be repeated in the future. Protesters gather outside London's Downing Street demanding leaders of the Group of Seven countries to stop selling arms to Israel. Also ahead, officials in the Russian capital order non-essential workers to stay home as COVID-19 cases hit a six-month high in Moscow. Welcome to the program. Our top story, Iran says there are still a lot of technical, legal, and political discussions that need to be made before attempts to revive the nuclear deal can bear fruit. Iran's top negotiator, Abbas Araghchi, says Tehran is seeking assurances that the U.S. will not withdraw from the deal again. Homa Lezgi reports.
The head of Iran's delegation to nuclear talks in Vienna, Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi, says there are still many technicalities that need to be resolved before a final agreement can be reached. Iran and the remaining signatories of the nuclear deal known as the JCPOA have been engaged in talks to bring the U.S. back into the deal and to ensure Iran's full compliance since April. Iran says it will only implement its nuclear commitments after it verifies the effective removal of all U.S. sanctions, including additional ones imposed under former President Donald Trump, who withdrew from the deal in 2018. Iran is seeking assurances the U.S. will not do so again.
They have to ensure the Islamic Republic of Iran that what happened in the past is not going to be repeated itself in the future. For that, we need lots of political, legal, and technical discussions. We continue these discussions and these talks as long as needed.
Russian envoy Mikhail Ulyanov said the differences of opinion between Iran and the U.S. are not many, but they are of principle character. The main unresolved issue at this stage, he said, is how the agreement will be implemented, who will do what, and when. The EU, which acts as coordinator, said the sides are making progress, but that negotiations are intense on a number of remaining issues.
The EU will continue with the talks with all the participants to the JCPOA and separately with the United States to find ways to get very close to a final agreement in the coming days. Thank you.
Araghchi said he did not think the sides could come to a final conclusion in this round, adding that Iran would continue negotiations as long as necessary and until its key concerns were addressed. Homa Lezgi, Vienna.
Political commentator Scott Bennett says there is no guarantee that the U.S. administrations would remain committed to deals reached by their predecessors.
A presidential administration can change, moment by moment, day by day, any and all agreements and any and all treaties and such that are entered into. So there's really no firm reliance or absolute dependability on an American presidential administration and these promises. However, if I was advising the Iranians, I would say the best way to guarantee and ensure that the United States government and the presidential administration commits to and fulfills and honors all of the elements and promises of the JCPOA is to make it absolutely attractive and a deal that the American people themselves could not turn down. And that's really the target of all negotiation and diplomatic communications and public relations and persuasion operations should be towards the American people, not the government, not the military-industrial complex, not the Zionists in Congress or the Mossad-friendly puppets who have been extorted.
As the G7 summit reaches its climax in Cornwall, a day of rage and action for Palestine has been underway this Saturday to condemn world leaders for their lack of action in protecting Palestinians from Israeli aggression. Protests took place up and down the UK, but in London, thousands mobilized outside Downing Street demanding change. Robert Carter has more.
As the G7 descended on Cornwall for the summit, thousands of passionate pro-Palestine protesters amassed outside Downing Street in central London on Saturday to vent their anger over ongoing Israeli crimes against the Palestinians.
These protesters are absolutely furious at the lack of action from world leaders following Israel's recent and relentless attacks on Gaza and the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Although a ceasefire has been agreed since then, the fact that Palestinians are still forced to live under an apartheid regime has bitterly fueled the anger of these protesters who want to force a change.
Protesters had various demands, including international recognition of the Palestinian state and an end to Israeli arms sales.
If arms are used in violation of international law, they must be banned, embargoed immediately. Also, the issue of settlement products, they must be banned immediately. Those are illegal products. The recognition of the state of Palestine is long overdue. We do not understand why the UK government is not even listening to the voices of its own people, the voices of its own parliament that voted overwhelmingly to recognize the state of Palestine. The lack of recognition is not only immoral, it is undemocratic.
Place an embargo on Israel. Stop the arms deal. So this is the message that we're sending to. The people are with us. We're in our thousands. And we are going to continue until, honestly, the Palestinians are free and occupation is ended.
We are not going to forget the mark of shame upon the history of this country that brought us to where we are today, the Balfour Declaration. We demand a public apology from the British government as well as recognition of our state of Palestine. On top of that, we want sanctions now. We want justice. We want action.
The bombs may have temporarily stopped falling, but while Israel's systematic discrimination against the Palestinian people continues, so will the protests. Robert Carter, London.
International lawyer John Philpott believes Western leaders who have committed crimes against Palestinian people to have to be brought to justice.
People have to understand that if you sell arms that are going to be used to kill people in an occupation, because it's an occupation, right? Gaza is a concentration camp. They have the right to shoot at those who occupy them and keep them in prison. But if people, the U.S. is selling apparently better arms because their arms, the arms that Israel had, were not as accurate. So those who sell the arms are liable. If I sell a gun to my neighbor who goes and robs a bank, I am accomplice to that crime. And that applies to the U.S. leaders. It probably applies to Britain, and Canada sells arms to Israel, and Britain does. And it's not the ICC. I wouldn't want to emphasize the zeal of the ICC. But they are liable. The leaders who committed the crimes must be held liable, both criminally and civilly. In the, they must repair the damages. They must provide reparation.
European leaders deliver an ultimatum to UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson to keep his Brexit pledges to resolve a row over new trade arrangements in Northern Ireland. The European Commission President and the European Council Chief said both sides must implement what they agreed on, stressing that there is complete unity among EU members. German Chancellor Angela Merkel also called for a pragmatic solution to the thorny issue of post-Brexit trade in Northern Ireland. Johnson has called for a compromise. He has threatened emergency measures if no solution is found over part of the post-Brexit deal that covers border issues with Northern Ireland. London and Brussels are at loggerheads over the Northern Ireland protocol of the post-Brexit deal. Political commentator Keith Pilbeam says British Prime Minister Johnson is trying to fight the consequences of Brexit.
You know, Boris Johnson is finding out the consequences of Brexit and the deal that he signed. I mean, he only signed this deal just before Christmas. It's not even 5 months old, and he's trying to renege on it and disown it. Maybe he signed it and thought he could just disown it. But what he's learning is there's international law, and you have to respect it. And you have to be trusted on the international stage. And so if you renege on this within 5 months and start invoking Article 16, you know, saying it's all a crisis and without that, then you're risking your reputation. And the point is, there was a choice to be made. There was either going to be a border in Ireland, which would have been terrible, or you have the border down the sea, the Irish Sea, you know, between Britain and Northern Ireland. And that's what's happened. And there was only two possibilities, once you leave the single market and the customs union. Had we stayed in the customs union, by the way, a lot of this would have been avoided. So these are the decisions that Boris Johnson took. They're the contract that he signed, and then he's trying to blame the EU for not playing good faith. Well, it's unbelievable. And it's coming home to roost now. He missold Brexit. He missold it to the British people. He missold it to the Northern Irish people. And now we're seeing the consequences. And, of course, if it was not for COVID, this would be front page. You know, every day, the consequences of Brexit. It's all hidden behind the COVID.
At least 18 people have been killed and several wounded in two separate artillery attacks on the northern Syrian town of Afrin. First attack reportedly hit a residential area, with a second one targeting a hospital shortly afterwards. A local Turkish official cited hospital sources as saying the Kurdish YPG militants hit the building with a missile. The official said Turkish artillery units shelled rural positions near the city of Ma'arat and Noman. In response, Turkey views the U.S.-backed YPG as a terrorist organization. In 2019, Turkey launched a cross-border operation in neighboring Syria under the pretext of pushing YPG-affiliated forces away from its borders. Thousands of Israelis demonstrate outside Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's residence in Jerusalem al-Quds. Take a look. The protest comes on the eve of a crucial vote in parliament that could end the reign of the regime's longest-serving prime minister. Anti-Netanyahu protesters have staged rallies on an almost weekly basis since last July to denounce his handling of COVID-19 and the economy. Anti-Netanyahu sentiments have been deepened by his indictment while being in office. The premier is accused of accepting improper gifts and seeking to trade regulatory favors with media moguls in exchange for positive coverage. Israel's parliament will vote on the formation of a new cabinet on Sunday. If approved, Naftali Bennett would take over, leading an alliance of right-wing, left-wing, centrist, and Arab parties. Israeli forces have shot dead a Palestinian woman at a military checkpoint north of Jerusalem al-Quds. Israeli forces alleged that the woman had planned to carry out a stabbing attack at Qalandia checkpoint. Her brother said she died of her wounds after being left lying on the ground. Palestinian officials identified the victim as 27-year-old Ibtissam Kabni. She had been detained and sentenced to 18 months in jail by Israel in 2016. Meanwhile, the Islamic Jihad movement condemned the killing as, quote, the ugliest form of terrorism. The Gaza-based resistance movement also criticized the international community's silence on Israel's atrocities. This comes a day after Israeli forces shot dead a 15-year-old Palestinian near the northern West Bank town of Nablus. Our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, says Palestinians shot dead over the past week in the occupied territories were killed in cold blood, and they posed no possible threat to the Israeli forces.
Israeli police issued a statement saying that a Palestinian woman arrived at the Columbia military checkpoint to the south of Ramallah near Jerusalem Al-Quds, and that she tried that she had a knife. The Israeli soldiers opened fire at her, shot her, and left her on the ground bleeding. They didn't even rescue her. We have to mention that many Palestinians were shot dead in cold blood, mainly at Israeli military checkpoints on mere suspicions. And later, it was discovered or revealed that none of those Palestinians who were killed on cold blood have posed any threat to the Israeli soldiers. If the Israelis were, their story was right, or their claims were right, then why they didn't post any videos for this Palestinian woman? However, a video posted online showed Ibtissam Ka'adni on the ground lying with Israeli soldiers around her. This is the story of the Israeli police.
New COVID-19 restrictions have been announced in the Russian capital, Moscow, amid a rise in the number of coronavirus infections there. Mayor of Moscow has announced what he called a non-working week for all non-essential workers. Restrictions include the closure of food courts and playgrounds, while restaurants and cafes are ordered to close between 11 p.m. and 6 a.m. The city has logged 6,700 new daily infections. That is the highest figure since December. Cases are also soaring in Russia's second-largest city of St. Petersburg, which is co-hosting the Euro 2020 football championship.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish. The 13th presidential election. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Iran's 13th presidential election is going to be held on June 18th. Election and political participation is a way to choose an official or officials for a specific post. Election is the symbol of people's rule over their own fate. However, elections in some countries are quiet, ceremonial, and a mere show of democracy. In Iraq, there are two kinds of elections. One is the election of city councils. Each province in Iraq is considered as a domain and enjoys its specific administrative establishment and provincial council. The other election is the parliamentary election. The president is also elected by the parliament. The president should be a Sunni Kurd. The parliament speaker should be a Sunni Arab, and the prime minister should be a Shia. In Syria, the president is elected for 7 years. Parliamentary and city council elections are other elections that are held in this country. In Kuwait, there are elections for city councils and parliament. The parliamentary election functions stronger in this country in comparison with other Arab countries in the region. Saudi Arabia is the only country which has not experienced any election so far. The monarchic regime has never allowed the people to go to ballot boxes to elect their desired officials. The United Arab Emirates has a parliamentary election every 4 years, which is totally ceremonial, as the parliament has no power before the royal family. Bahrain is just like the UAE. Yusuf Al-Huri, Bahraini political activist, says on democracy in the Arab countries of the Persian Gulf region, "The fact is that the systems of the Arab countries of the Persian Gulf region have not come to power on the basis of election. The ruling systems in these countries have rather come to power by colonialist systems like Britain, and they are supported by this country so that they may be able to continue their rule and exchange interests with each other. Today, we know it well that it is the British who caused Al Khalifa to rule in Bahrain and have supported them so far," unquote. Dear listeners, the same is true with Saudi Arabia. The system of governance is almost the same in Kuwait, UAE, and Qatar. In Qatar, the only election that is held is related to the city councils. But in Oman, as a royal system, the members of parliament are elected by people. In Lebanon, there are three kinds of election: the presidential election, the parliamentary election, and the city council election are held in this country. The president is chosen by the parliament. In Jordan, there are two legislative houses. The members of the House of Commons and the Senate are appointed by the king, while the representatives of parliament are elected by people. In North Africa, democratic process is more obvious and has a longer record. In Tunisia, for instance, both presidential and parliamentary elections are held. Elections are more seriously pursued in the country after the nationwide uprising and Islamic awakening in 2010. In Morocco, as a royal system, there are two elections for the House of Representatives and the House of Advisors. In Algeria, both presidential and parliamentary elections are held, while in Sudan, only the presidential election is held. In each of the mentioned countries, various elections are held, but participation is very limited in many of them. That's why free and fair election has always been one of the serious demands of people.
your thought.
Hello, dear friends, and let us start the day by pondering on an aphorism from Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him. Incapacity is a catastrophe. Endurance is bravery. Abstinence is riches. Self-restraint is a shield against sin. And the best companion is submission to Allah's will.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This man changed the world.
Our bosses couldn't cope with the idea of an 80-year-old Ayatollah, which they didn't even know what an Ayatollah was, who lived on garlic and onions and yogurt, directing a revolution that was about to topple America's most important ally.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Exalted, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Salam, hello, and welcome to our audience, and particularly a warm welcome to our listeners of our program, The Man Who Changed the World and is Still Changing It. Once again, we are going to be speaking about the life and times of Imam Khomeini, this great and holy personality who has certainly changed the world forever. And I'm going to, as usual, have a in-depth discussion about this great man's life with Dr. Hassani, who is once again has joined us on this program to discuss this very, very important personality, and I thank him for that. And Dr. Hassani, salam and welcome to the program.
Assalamu alaikum.
Dr. Hassani, we finished off on the point about Ahlul Bayt. I think we were discussing the significance of the belief in this particular hadith that we were talking about in terms of the legacy of the Holy Prophet. And of course, Imam Khomeini, we mentioned before, comes from the holy family of the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, and he re-emphasized that very important hadith for the whole Muslim world, that there are two very, very valuable things that we should focus on, and that is the Holy Quran and the holy family of the Prophet. And that these two things should be given the importance and priority that they deserve. But to begin with, you know, we have to look at this great personality from the point of view that how does one actually study a great personality like Imam Khomeini? What's the kind of approach that's required in terms of trying to get to grips with such a complicated personality as Imam Khomeini, because there are many, many dimensions to this holy soul that we have been discussing over the last 10 programs, because it's not only a kind of one-dimensional personality, this is a multi-dimensional personality, and it's very difficult for, I think, many, many people. I mean, there's a book that has been published on Imam Khomeini, which is a compilation of what people have thought as in terms of expertise in politics, in economics, in religion, whatever it happens to be. in a book called Asr Imam Khomeini, the era of Imam Khomeini. But to be honest, even going through that book, even when I was looking through that and, you know, translating it from Persian, you find that, you know, simply seem to see one side or one aspect of this multidimensional being. And yet, they don't quite fully grasp what he's done. So, Dr. Hassani, tell us, because you're a researcher and an academic in the Holy Seminaries of Qom, as well as for the academia in Tehran, tell us, how does one actually approach this personality?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome.
This is a very delicate subject.
Yeah.
I'm going to try to give you
sure.
the most simple example in order how to approach to study such a person like Imam Khomeini, peace be upon him. And by the way, we are going to try. You know, there is no claim on our side.
Absolutely. Sure. I mean, really, yeah, of course. I mean, trying is the word.
In order to understand somebody, you have to know the background of his life.
True.
I give it to you simple. The way that you should study somebody's life, you can look at what kind of claim he has, or she, for that matter.
Right.
What the claim might be, this is the beginning of to enter the gate of studying. You know, in English, the word search and research.
Yeah.
Search is more simpler than research, of course.
Yeah, of course it is.
When you lose something, you know, let's suppose you lose your car key.
Right.
And if you ask your wife, where is that?
Yeah. The national, and she always tells you it's
exactly,
in your pocket.
But to get serious, if it's not in your pocket and you misplace it,
sure.
the natural thing to say is, why don't you look for it?
Yeah.
Why don't you search for it?
Search for it.
But you don't use the word research.
No, you don't.
If you search for it once, if you look for it once, and you still cannot find it, they might say to you, why don't you re-look somewhere else?
Sure.
In order to understand so many different things, different phenomena, if you look at the word itself, it helps you to begin with. Let me give you an example. What Imam Khomeini claimed in his holy life, that 80 some years of his age within us, that was a big claim. I can tell you right away, he had the same claim that Prophet did.
And that, what claim was that?
The claim is that everybody should live according to the rules and laws of the Creator to be a good person.
Right.
For example, in order to study the life, the holy life of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and his holy progeny.
Sure.
In order to understand Islam, you have to study his life. In order to understand what kind of background he's coming from, what kind of claim, and that was a big claim, by the way.
Yeah.
He was Rahmatan lil Alameen.
That's right, the mercy to
for
mankind.
The entire mankind.
For the whole of mankind, yes.
Not just the mankind of his own time,
sure,
but for the rest of creation.
Yes.
For
and of course the Holy Prophet had to also validate his prophethood as well, because there were many other monotheistic followers, or Hanifs even, who followed Prophet Abraham, who followed Prophet Moses, for example, or Christianity as Prophet Jesus.
Which is a chain order.
Yeah, chain order.
Of
but
the
they,
same message.
But they said, as far as they were concerned, they turned around and they said to the Holy Prophet, that, look, we've been given the last revelation. We have the last claim on this matter. Where do you come into all this?
So, in order to study Islam and the life of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, the first thing comes to your mind, the location, the geography that he lived in.
Right.
Of course, it was Arabian Peninsula. But in order to look at the bigger picture, you have to study the entire globe at that time.
Yes.
This is something, you know, often we forget or we take for granted.
Yes.
We say it's enough to learn about the new, it wasn't, by the way, it wasn't a new religion. It was the continuation of all the religion that Prophet Abraham was talking about, Prophet Noah, and so on and so forth.
Because
it was a completion of...
It was the completion of...
The whole program.
Yeah, whole program.
So one thing comes to mind, you know, during the time of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, the ignorant of the people at the time. For example, they killed their own daughters by their own hand.
Yes.
For whatever the reason, we're not going to get into that.
No.
But my question to you is this,
sure.
Brother Ejaz.
Yes.
Have you ever thought about what people did in China back then?
Yes, I have.
But you have to put everything
because
in perspective.
Because you're right. No, what I'm
you talk
saying
about
is
civilization, you talk about the culture.
Exactly,
here.
Because you know what you're saying is, and it's beautifully put, and that's absolutely right, that you know when you think of 7th century,
mm-hmm.
you have to think exactly what the world was like in the 7th century.
Exactly, you have to study Romans at the same time.
Exactly, because of course, I mean the
Persian, they called them.
Yeah, I mean, in the 7th century, Rome itself as a republic had stood for almost 1,000 years. And, you know, had conquered most of the known world at that time.
That is true.
And the thing is that, as you say, we are putting everything in a context. So what you're saying is the beginning of your search is really
by
looking...
By definition. Research is not something just, you know, you do it on surface.
Exactly.
You have to go into a deeper...
And more broader understanding of exactly what's happening.
All different phenomena that you can find.
Exactly.
Okay?
Yeah.
So... Indian, for example, Chinese back
exactly.
then,
yeah.
Persians, mm-hmm. Romans,
mm-hmm.
How about Egyptians?
Yes, one of the oldest standing civilizations in the region.
See, you have to think about the whole thing, the
sure.
whole picture.
Yeah.
Same thing goes with the life of Imam Khomeini, peace be upon him.
Yes, quite.
You have to study not just what was going on inside Iran back
mm-hmm.
then,
mm-hmm.
okay?
Mm-hmm.
Domestically, you have to know
mm-hmm.
what kind of mentality people had back then.
Sure.
What kind of... economical situation they were in.
In other words, in terms of understanding how outstanding and how awesome Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi was in terms of what he, as you say, what he claimed, but we have to see it in the light of the fact that he's in the face of a very dominant, powerful culture at that
exactly.
time.
Exactly.
For which they
Iran,
had no answer.
The position of Iran domestically...
Yeah.
In the regional, in what they call the Middle East,
sure.
and the role of foreigners.
Yes.
American government.
Both in the country and outside
the
country.
Both in the country and outside.
Yeah.
All these different phenomena, different realities on the ground, it affects your research.
Of course it does.
And it draws the conclusion differently.
Yes.
Okay?
Yes.
What kind of economical situation was established in Iran? Before revolution, and you have to get, don't get
yeah,
me wrong,
yeah.
you have to go way back,
yeah.
at least for 20 years before revolution.
Yes.
What kind of mentality Imam, what kind of background Imam Khomeini was coming from?
Yes.
This is very important in
yeah.
doing research.
Yeah.
And you always have to go back again and do the check and balance.
Exactly.
And check it with the references.
Well, I mean, this is the thing that, you know, like, as you point out, I mean, there's many references involved here because... Imam Khomeini is coming on the back, not only on the back, but also was leading in many ways this very revolutionary change in Iran because, you know, the fact that, you know, he had a referendum right at the beginning, which was outstanding. I mean, nobody expected that a guy who would come out of Hawza, who would come out of the seminaries, would preach a referendum to validate a republic, an
and
Islamic republic.
You have to be as big as the universe itself in order to tackle this kind of problem.
Exactly.
This is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay?
Exactly.
Because we believe, you know.
Mm.
By the way, Imam Khomeini lived according to his belief.
Yeah, sorry, but on the background that you had dictatorship in the form of monarchy, where the vote was not heard of, and when the CIA got whiff of the fact that Mossadegh, the prime minister in 1951,
you know,
was going down this road.
It's easy to say that the system was monarchy.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
But for them, they acted like a pharaoh. They were so big.
Yeah.
I mean, they would call themselves all this king of kings.
Kings,
they
yes.
called themselves the shadow of God.
Yes, there was so also that claim
made,
as
that
well.
That made the story different.
Yes.
I mean, for us, after revolution, we're talking about, Brother Ejaz, this is years after. The revolution, the Islamic revolution we're talking, it's so easy to talk.
Yeah.
But in order to put yourself in that situation, it's very difficult and it takes time. And it takes a struggle in order to understand it.
Yeah.
You know, our claim is this, that Islam is a perfect one, perfect program for humanity,
sure.
the entire globe.
Sure.
So this is a big claim.
Yeah.
And Imam Khomeini in claiming and believing in this is not
is no exception.
No.
But the thing is that as a great leader, everything he claimed, he had to have a backup.
Yeah.
A social understanding to begin with.
Yeah.
Okay? After all, Islam is a collective, comprehensive, general, it's a broad religion,
yeah,
which claims that it can take good care of every human
need,
affairs and needs.
And needs, yes.
And it will. Yeah. You have to prove it that.
Where?
Because we have to come up with a social, mm-hmm, and economical and political system.
Yeah.
And you know, nowadays,
well, I mean, to be fair,
you can see the result of
to
it.
Be fair, as you say, that, you know, when you put this into a context, and that's very important in terms of research, and that is what you're saying, that the approach has to be comprehensive. Because if you, it's like, you know, like we're doing modeling, for example. I mean, I come from an engineering background, and of course, if your model lacks...
Which makes a good example.
Yeah, if your model lacks certain assumptions which don't really fill the parameters of the exact thing that you're trying to analyze, well, the result is going to be pretty
and
skewed.
And you always have, in order to write a good building,
yeah,
you always have to use the plumb line.
Exactly, exactly. But what I'm saying here is that we want to put all the ingredients into our research approach so that we get the right kind of, we take the right kind of, what do you call the result that we really need in terms of understanding the entire approach that this great personality did? Because as you say, the claim is very great. But to be fair, in the context of history, even though, you know, that's very controversial, and many of us who have studied Muslim history in the past come away with a very negative impression of the overall picture of what the Muslim world was like for many, many centuries, but we can't ignore the fact that Islam, even in whatever shape or form it was for many centuries, dominated the entire globe for almost 1,000 years, for which Europe had no answer. Even though the Muslim world was broken up into 3 or 4 empires. There was the Empire of Spain, of Andalusia, there was the Empire of the Mughal India, there was the Empire of the Safavids in Iran, there was the Empire of the Ottomans. So, I mean, although they come in successive chronological order, I mean, we're not saying they're all happening at the same time, but whatever periods of history in which there were fundamental changes, but even though at the end of the day, Europe, whatever modern Europe is now, it couldn't have happened unless Islam was there. So, although we are saying it's a big claim for many, many needs, but it's because there has been a vacuum since the time that these empires collapsed and then Muslims started to fall backwards economically, politically, because Europe started to take over and started to dominate the rest of history until the present day. But in that light, Imam Khomeini is still coming from a context in which Islam still left a very great legacy for the rest of the world to follow.
Big claim deserves big struggle.
Sure.
Okay, the moment you're not claiming anything, so you, it's so easy for you to deal with whatever. Nobody's going to ask you. Nobody's going to question you. Nobody's going to challenge you.
Yeah.
But the moment you claim something,
yeah,
you have to
validate it.
You have to validate it. You have to come out of it clean.
Sure.
Okay, in order to finish that introduction that I gave
for
those that please they do have some problems. You know, we talk about ideology here.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay?
Mm.
Those people, and they're coming from different school of thought, whatever, for what different reason. We're not getting into that. Mm. It's not going to help us much.
Yeah.
But to those that who claim they always that coming Islam, returning Islam inside the country, the Persia, it's very easy for them to say they call it Arab invasion. Which wasn't the case.
No,
you
it
talk
wasn't.
About if you talk about material, how come a great empire like Persian, like old Persian empire, could collapse in a short period of time? And they claim that Arab soldiers, you know, they came to Iran with sword. So Iranian army back then. They didn't have sword to defend their own country.
Let's put it in some historical context. Here we are talking about...
Because when you do research, you have to do a lot of
studies. We are talking about the time...
You have to do a lot of comparison.
Exactly.
You have to do a lot of different things.
Well, there's a lot of PhDs that have been written on the thesis that have been done on this research. But we're talking about...
All of those PhDs doesn't mean please hold a debate.
No.
So they should be able, in order to back whatever they say with
exactly.
with facts.
But the thing is, whatever they've come up with, and this has stunned them, in all honesty, when they have come up with these, and I've seen some of these theses, where they have been absolutely stunned by the extraordinary speed with which the Muslim empire started to expand. Because we're talking about, as you quite rightly say, a Persian empire that stood for about...
What happened? This is a simple question.
Yeah, 3,500 years... Right? You know, taking it to its origin, but it only collapses within the 10-year period of the second caliph, if I can put it that way, within a matter of a year or two. Mm-hmm. It's extraordinary. How does that happen?
One should ask himself why.
Why? Exactly.
You know, we don't have to give answers to any questions.
No.
I mean, the approach for some people should be differently.
Yeah.
I mean, for as long as you want to stay student, you're not going to grow.
Yeah.
All these different lectures, speeches you go to, all different books you read, which is fine. Mm. You're supposed to do that.
Sure.
But for a second, come out of yourself. Mm. This is my claim.
Yeah.
This is my way of approaching things.
Sure.
You have to pause for a second and say, look, I am somebody in this creation too.
Sure.
I can be as big as whoever. Mm. I can achieve as much as
whoever
somebody else
sure.
did. Okay?
Sure.
There is an Imam Khomeini inside every single of us because we're going to talk about that claim. That claim is of a genuine one. Mm. When you talk about justice, you're not talking about something in vacuum.
No.
You talk about reality on the ground. You know, back during Shah's regime,
sure.
we lived it. Mm. I felt it. I saw the unjust, okay, with different talent, good talent, you know, bunch of elite people, if they were not attached to the system, to the monarch system, if, for example, they disputed, they challenged the system of king, which was very difficult,
sure.
they could face torture, they could face imprisonment, they could face to be sent into exile, just like they sent Imam Khomeini to exile.
Sure.
Okay, what did he do? What did he say for the regime, you know, to actually, if you want to describe it, the way that they took Imam from his house in Qom, it was some kind of kidnapping.
Sure.
How come a civilization, somebody who claims that he can take care of people?
Well, Dr. Husni, I wanted to say here that you're drawing a very, very interesting parallel here because you already... You're drawing a line here where you're saying that it's that interesting.
And my mission here is to raise questions. So many different of them.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is, if you let me finish my point,
please.
That is that there's two interesting parallels you're drawing here. You're drawing about how Iran or the Persian Empire, in the context of the 7th, 8th century, how it quickly was absorbed by Islam. And which was a miracle in itself, and that's something that, as you quite rightly say, is something that, you know, PhDs have been written on. But we are drawing also the fact that the Pahlavi regime in Iran was established for, you know, in a coup d'état in 1941, the Mohammad Reza Pahlavi that we knew, the one that was
the role of British behind it,
the British and the Americans in the coup,
U.S. administration. Yes.
50 years it was established by the great superpowers. The principal superpower being the Americans.
And 50 years is a long way.
A long way. Where
to
Iran,
gain people's heart.
Exactly. And in Iran, it was established as the policeman of the Gulf.
The gendarme of the region.
With a very, very powerful army. One of the strongest in the region. Even Israel was no match for whatever the Shah was getting at the time. And how did that quickly dissolve the way it did? By this great personality. I mean, it draws two very interesting parallels about Iran's history in the face of Islam.
Good question again. If you go look at the history, what kind of situation people were in? My answer to you is very simple. It all boils down to one thing. And the word is dignity. We're talking about reference here. Lagat karamna bani adam. Quran is talking to us. Anytime you want to study somebody, look or study the ideology behind that
person.
Mentality, behind that person.
Person, yes.
You cannot study Imam Khomeini without knowing Quran.
Would I be wrong in saying, Dr. Hasni, dignity and faith?
Dignity and faith, they're going together. Okay?
Right.
But dignity is something that if somebody claims, you know, on the surface that, oh, I don't believe in, even if I don't believe in God, but I'm not a beast, I'm not animal, I'm human for God's sake. Then he says, for God's sake. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Unintentionally uses the word.
Word.
Okay?
Because God gave
because
the dignity,
God gave him
the honor and dignity
God,
to man.
God gave it to him.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
Dignity is not something.
And it's being trampled on by dictatorship.
Exactly. And this is what you see. If you ask me what happened to Egyptian people, why they came to the Tahrir Square to regain their dignity. The dignity that it was kidnapped, it was hijacked.
Hijacked.
It was robbed, I
robbed,
should say.
Robbed, yes.
This is
robbed,
a better
I
word.
Think, is a better word. Yeah.
If you feel that you are abused, okay,
yeah.
If you all feel that you are attacked with every single cell in your entire body, by the way, if you have to talk about this in a deeper and different layer, you have to talk about the definition of human.
Yes.
According to what Islam
says. Yes, that's right, because that's the ideology we're coming from.
Because remember, one of the, we're talking about the human problems in general in the last program. And one thing I mentioned that we are trapped into these five
senses. That's right.
But there is something beyond
that.
Okay.
And this is what this expertise also witnessed to the fact that, you know, beyond whatever intelligence or whatever things were there in place in order to, because let's be honest here. Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh, was never, ever envisaged by the Americans or the Soviet Union for that matter, that such a person would ever come to power in Iran. They were expecting the Shah to be there forevermore. Amen. So, that, as you quite rightly say, according to that, those materialistic senses and sight, the intelligence went badly wrong.
Brother, when one way of studying one society is to get back to their song.
Get back to the hymn sheet.
Exactly. In West,
and start singing from the same one.
In West, you know as well as I do.
Yeah.
There is a song that says "No respect, no respect," and they repeated it.
Yeah.
And they mean it. When you're talking about dignity, Mr. Rajal, you're not talking about something in vacuum. You're talking about reality on the ground.
Absolutely.
We are different. By definition, from Quranic. If I get a chance to. Tell you about the reference and talk about it for a few seconds.
Sure. If not now, we'll do it in the next session. Yeah.
Hopefully.
Yeah.
Because it's very important in order to understand the root cause for people uprising.
For
people, if you ask them why you are not satisfied with your situation, the respect, the dignity, the nobility, brother. In one word, we are different than every. Different creation that the entire universe is based on. We are different in every different aspect. We have so many different dimensions. We have to understand and recognize and study ourselves. We have to get back to the drawing point.
Exactly. Exactly.
We have to talk about this stuff. Otherwise, you don't know the immensity of the claim. Which is big.
Well, let's make an attempt at it anyway, because in a program like this, this is what we're trying to do. But what we're seeing is, in our concluding remarks in this particular session, is that knowing thyself, which in transcendent philosophy or anything else you may like, we don't need to get complicated about it. But
no, we need to talk simple.
Simple. But knowing thyself makes you know your creator. And this is something that Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah, took right to the end of his life, because this is what he was trying to instill in us and to make us wake up to the fact of exactly who we are and what we are. But we'll leave it for this particular moment on this note. But I thank you very much, Dr. Hasni, for
thank
this
you for having me.
Yeah, for this very valuable discussion. Really, I've enjoyed it, and I hope listeners have enjoyed it too. And I hope you'll join us again on another session of The Man Who Changed the World. Thank you very much for listening. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May the peace and mercy and blessings of Allah be upon you all.
The light. A muralist from Greece is blending mythology with graffiti and street art to depict how COVID-19 has impacted lives around the globe. Ficus Antonios has painted the walls of many cities around the globe. He is now in the Cypriot capital, Nicosia, to continue his work. His latest artwork depicts Americus, a Cypriot mythical figure who was punished by the gods and turned into a plant. The Greek artist believes this theme is similar to the situation people around the globe have experienced since the pandemic began. He explains many people have grown roots because they're staying in one place for so long. Two British artists have brought a combination of fun, art, and environmental concerns to the sidelines of the G7 summit. They have created a modern-day version of famous sculpture carved into America's Mount Rushmore. This time, it's called Mount Recyclemore. Joe Rush and Alex Rackage have made a sculpture of G7 leaders with electronic waste. They say their major goal is to raise awareness about the amount of unrecycled tech and gadgets, the damage they cause to the environment, and the ways to combat the issue internationally.
Well, what I'd like them to do, the leaders of the G7 conference, is I'd like them all to talk to each other and work out a plan that isn't just shifting the problem from one country to another, you know, but actually is a plan that we all work on together, which is how to deal with this waste. And how to stop producing so much waste and how to recycle things. And all these issues have got to be dealt with globally. They can't be dealt with nationally because that's where the problem is. So we need them all to get together, like we've put them together here, and deal with the problem.
The United Nations says 53 million tons of electronic waste are generated annually all over the world. It estimates that the amount of the waste will double in less than 30 years. If that happens, electronic waste would become the fastest growing waste stream in the world. Advanced robots are increasingly helping humans in a variety of innovative ways. Now they have found a place in the healthcare system and will help nurses and doctors stay safe during the COVID-19 pandemic.
I can do all kinds of things for elderly people. I can visit with people and brighten their day with social stimulation, entertain and help guide exercise, but also can do talk therapy, take bio readings and help healthcare providers assess their health and deliver treatments.
Grace, which is the newest humanoid robot to join the healthcare fleet. This intelligent machine can take temperatures and record other vital signs of patients. It has been designed in a way to also interact with the elderly.